It's Friday, May 15th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 147 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 6 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chris.
That sounded so terribly unenthusiastic.
I want to call him Salim.
Chris, are you in the bathroom again?
No, I'm in my my ad hoc recording studio up here in
the bathroom.
No, I'm not in the bathroom yet. I moved out of there.
All right, real quick, March of Dimes. We're going to link it one last time in the show notes just for posterity. But we did make our goal, and so I'll be posting pictures of myself now with short hair. I want to thank you guys for doing a really great thing here for raising about $1,000 for really excellent cause. Good stuff. Great job, everyone. Once again, yes. Just proving the quality of community that there is.
You guys are fantastic.
The forum registration we mentioned last show.
Yes.
I want to remind you guys, if you're trying to register for our forum and you don't get the confirmation email, go to the contact form general mailbox and email Chad, who's now handling the general mailbox, the username you tried to sign up with on the forum.
Either email me at chadfeartheboot.com or what's the general mailbox?
It's just there's a
general.
The general mailbox goes to chad at feartheboot.com now. But common sense thing here, if you didn't get the confirmation email, you're probably not going to get an email from Chad telling you that you've been cleared.
Right.
So Chad said he's running about a 24-hour turnaround time. So just send him an email. And
some people I've been able to get in contact with, others I haven't. And then there's a pretty good rate going right now of people where it's just like, and we'll say 28 to 48 hours, you should have something.
28 to 48.
What, 24 to 48.
Wow. So if I check back in like 27, it's
yeah,
not
27.
Gonna be
no,
exactly.
No,
no, sir. 28
so,
hours.
Yeah, just keep trying over the next day or two and you'll be good. Real quick, there's a float and camping trip coming up. June.
Organized yet again through the forums. This is a good opportunity. I'm sorry to interrupt on the float trip thing, but you know, we have a really great forum community.
Yeah, we actually did not organize this at all. This is organized through a bunch of forumites. But if you are free the weekend of June 5th through the 7th, there is going to be a Fear the Boot camping trip and float trip. Now, apparently a float trip is a unique local thing, which I didn't realize.
It seems really strange to me. I mean, I know we're
a
lot of...
I wouldn't say it's a local thing.
Well, I think the terminology is.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the terminology is local because I've never heard of such things.
Yeah.
Well, you're from Iowa.
No, but I mean, being from Minnesota where we have more than enough water, I never heard of the term float used in that way.
You would never go out on a boat in Minnesota because you just freeze your wanky off.
But the way a float trip works, obviously, you know how camping works. Basically, what a float trip is
canoes and beer and floating down the river at a leisurely pace.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You just grab canoes, in some cases, inflatable rafts, a whole lot of
inner tubes,
and you just float down the river. You socialize, you drink. It's very relaxed, a lot of fun. If you're interested in doing this, there's a ton of details you're going to need to know, and you're also going to need to make some reservations. I'm going to link in the show notes to a Facebook page that has all the information on this. And so you'll want to check that out. I'm going to be there for at least part of it. I don't know if I'll be able to stay for the whole thing, but I'll at least be there for some of it. There are several other people that have said they're going to come in for this. So if you are free that weekend, definitely stop by. It's just a hangout and have fun sort of thing. And I think it's going to be a ton of fun. Last announcement, Gen Con coming up here in August. And this year, for a variety of reasons, Fear the Boot does not have any organized events at Gen Con. So here's what we are going to do. Last year, we had some people that we called the Toft Bitches.
Yes.
Now,
my men, my Toft Bitches.
That's, despite how it sounds, not an obscenity. It's actually an abbreviation.
These guys are elite operatives.
It's an abbreviation of the official Fear the Boot communications hub. And when you put that out in letters, looks like Toft Bitch. What these
Ed
guys
and Dan,
what these guys are going to do is this. Every time something's going on that involves Fear the Boot guys, It could be a listener. It could be a host. But somebody says, hey, I'm going to go over to this restaurant, grab a few beers. Who wants to come?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I want to do some guerrilla gaming. Just do a really quick throw together of a pickup game right now. These guys are going to serve as a communications hub. They're mm-hmm. going to send out morning messages via text message or phone call, letting you know what's going on. And anytime someone does an impromptu event, they're going to keep you connected. So this is a great way to stay tapped into what your fellow booters are doing. What you need to do if you want to be a part of this is go to feartheboot.com/GenCon, and I'll also link this in the show notes. And there is a sign-up form there where you can give them your information, and they're going to put it in a spreadsheet or whatever mm-hmm. they're going to do. And that will keep you tapped in. So whenever an announcement goes out, you will be on the receiving list so you can come join us, or so you yourself can get in touch with them and kick off an event. So if you're going to be at Gen Con and you're at all interested in hanging out with some really cool people, and mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the hosts, I'm talking about the fans.
That's right.
Then definitely.
You know, I don't go to meet the host because I know these assholes all the time. I go to meet you guys because you guys are awesome.
So feartheboot.com/GenCon.
Yeah, and you were saying at the beginning that we don't have any panels this year through, I don't know why. You know,
well,
we just don't have any, but
there's a lot of long stories involved there I'm not going to go into, but
we actually are going to have a panel. It's just not going to be an official panel.
Yeah, we're thinking about doing a...
Thinking about nothing. This is going down.
We're thinking about doing a flash mob.
Yep. We're doing a guerrilla panel.
Well, there's going to be flashing involved?
Well, yes.
Okay,
maybe.
Cool.
Only you.
Awesome.
But see, what we're going to do is, since we don't have a place to hold a panel, we're just going to hold a panel anyway. We're going to find a location in Indy at the con, and we're going to say, be at this place at this time on this day, and we're going to be doing a Fear the Boot Live.
And basically flash mob and just do a Fear the Boot Live until security throws us out. Yeah.
And, you know, we'll give you all the information of where it's going to be and all the times and stuff well in advance so you can plan your games around. It's not going to be like a true flash mob where 100 people get a page and say, be here in 5 minutes. It's not going to be like that. We're going to give you guys plenty of advance notice. We just need to scout out a location where we can have this.
We can't give them a whole lot of advance notice, though, because the man might find out.
You know, I don't fear the man anymore.
No, you don't.
The screwdriver's gone. That's what's back, kiddies, from about 50 or 100 episodes ago. That's right. Anyway, all right, we got a lot of stuff to cover today, so let's get straight down to it.
I think it's gonna fall again and it's just gonna go off.
It's gonna destroy part of the
wall. It's gonna go off prematurely, as it does
all the time.
So
Dan has that problem.
There's a whole tangent that got started on our forums about the oddities of American censorship. I had to bleep out words like a-hole or the synonym for rooster. Yet,
cock?
Thanks. I wanted to bleep it out again. Yet all the time we're sitting there talking about necrophilia and hookers and cocaine.
Cocaine.
Look, folks, if you're in Europe,
one hell of a drug.
And it makes no sense to you, it makes no sense to us either, to be honest. So,
you know, because here at Fear the Boot, it's all hookers and blow.
Oh, baby.
All it is. But we do a post party after every episode. And it's nothing but 10 pounds of blow and 250 pound hookers. It's great.
All right.
BBWs.
So here we go. Yep.
Tell that hooker not to fart. She's going to blow my blow everywhere.
So before we get into part two of... It was a terrible transition from where that just went. Before we get into the... latter half, second part. I can't win here. Before we finish the thing,
you obviously
on dungeon
need
building,
more cocaine
for the back half. Yeah,
before you get in the back,
I want to throw something out here. I was thinking about this is a list,
mm-hmm.
and I'm curious to see what you guys would have to add to this list. Chris, in particular, I think last time you said you might have some stuff of your own, but this is 10 things, like a David Letterman thing here. 10 things being an older gamer has made me realize. So 10 things that I've learned after gaming for 20 some odd years.
There's no such thing as a clean character sheet. Or is that just me?
That's just you.
Mm. Okay.
The rest of us take care of our possessions. So thing number one, and by the way, these aren't necessarily comedic. Some of these may be, but this is mostly just realities I've become aware of. Thing number one, is the quote unquote glory days are gone forever.
My God.
Now,
bad games and bad game writing.
Well, what I mean by that is not necessarily there are no good games ahead of you, but what I do mean is stop trying to recreate your old groups and gaming experiences, because if you walk into your newer gaming groups trying to recreate what you had back in high school or college, it ain't going to happen. Look forward to the new experiences. Look forward to the new methods of gaming, the maturing of your gaming.
I've even seen that outside of gaming. Prime example is Johnny G in MMOs. He had a UO guild
right
back in the day, and this guild was freaking awesome, right? I would never played it, but I love hearing the stories. Basically, it was an in-character role-playing game guild in a server or an area on the servers or whatever they're called in UO. I never played the game, where there wasn't any role-playing. And they were playing orcs, except in UO, you can't play an orc.
So yeah, they would kill orcs, take their gear, and then dress up as orcs.
They put on a helmet because it was a top-down game, and they looked like an orc from the top down. And so the entire guild took over an orc castle or orc outpost or whatever and ran their guild out of that. But the game didn't change. It was still spawning orcs for this questing area of this orc thing. And whenever an orc spawned, it was one of the feral orcs, and they just killed it. And then players, quote unquote, human players or elves or whatever, would come to do quests there. Well, there'd be this huge ass guild there doing their guild thing. And they were like, humans are invading, get them. And they're like, the other players are like, what the hell are you talking about? We're just players like you. No, we're not. We're orcs. And they talked in character. And it was so popular that the GMs got wind of it. And they loved these guys so much, they gave them a charter for the guild, giving them, quote unquote, ownership of the guild or the orc outpost. And it's like sitting on the table of this orc outpost. And as far as we know to this day, that orc outpost is still there on that server with the charter still sitting on this virtual
and
table.
The punchline is he tried to recreate that like Age of Conan and a couple other games.
Every RPG every MMO I've ever seen him do, I've seen him try to recreate the glory days of that. And it just doesn't work.
Number two, don't expect too much out of gaming. Just because it's simplistic or not the way we used to do it doesn't mean it can't be fun.
I think there's someone at this table who's like that.
Yeah, I know. I think there's I think several people are like that. Here's the point. When you had all that time and you had all that energy and you had all those great ideas and you were sky high on energy drinks like Nitro that they don't make anymore.
It's just called Mountain Dew, people.
Just because
Nitro was better.
You know what? You can have games that are shorter, that are more simplistic, that are more fun, more streamlined, and that's okay. You don't have to have all the charts and graphs and posters. And number three, if you find a day that works, stick with it. If it turns out everyone's free on Thursday evening, even if Thursday evening gets to be a little bit tough, don't reschedule it, because what you will probably do is destroy the gaming group, because adult schedules are a real mess to line up. Thing number four, if you're completely out of it, do something else. But conversely, if you're just not quite feeling it, push yourself to do it anyway.
Where are you getting this list from?
Just to think, these are lessons I've learned.
You made this
list. I made this up.
Oh, okay.
I made this up.
I was like, I kept thinking, it's like, you know, I could apply every single one of these in some way to either you or people we know.
Yeah, this is, I made this up completely. Huh. But if you're completely out of it, do something else. Go bowling. But if you're just not quite feeling it, because guess what? With kids and a job, you're never going to quite feel it. Go try anyway, and you might be surprised how good the game turns out.
I think that's one of my big ones right there. So many times I have just, long day at work, I'm not feeling, I've even driven the games going, you know, I just really don't want to do this today. But it's like, okay, I'll give it the old couch. But then I end up having a ton of fun, because gaming is fun.
Thing number five, you have to think about the other people in your life now, wife, kids, job, but at the same time, you need to guard time for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't have a night out to game, now maybe there's some serious issue going on, like health problems or whatever, and I understand that. But the point being, and this is, you know, I think this is life advice, not gaming advice. If you've got a gaming night, you need to protect that. You need to have your night out to do your fun thing for your own emotional and social health.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, I'm surprised you have piped in with nothing.
Well, I figured you were going to go through your list. I mean, I got mine.
Oh, okay, but, okay. So you're going to give yours afterwards.
Well, I don't want to interrupt.
Okay, that's very polite of you.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
That's probably the first nice thing I've ever said about you.
First and only, maybe, yeah.
Number six, be aware of your ruts in game choice and style. Try new things, shop around. If you're completely out of touch with the gaming community, every so often just wander into your local gaming store and just see what's on the shelf.
You know, doing this podcast has taught us that lesson.
Oh, yes.
Very much so.
That's, once again, if we ever do the self-indulgent how podcasting's changed me things.
You know what I would add to that point, now that I will pipe in, is that, yes, I totally agree that you should always try something new and switch things up. But after a long time of not playing a game, go back to one of the classics that you played and rediscover how much fun it really was.
Yes.
Winners are winners for a reason.
I will agree with that. Yeah, sometimes dusting off the old game that's been out of print for 20 years isn't a rut. It's rediscovering a classic.
But you know what? Sometimes classics just don't live up to the memories. Like,
yeah, Playground's not as big as you thought it was.
Battletech is like that for me. Really great, fond memories of Battletech. And I still think Battletech's a wonderful setting and a wonderful game and all that. I honestly have absolutely zero desire to play Battletech.
Really?
Yeah, none whatsoever.
I do.
Too time-consuming, too big. I'm just not into it.
I hadn't played Battletech in years until I ran the event at Fear the Con, and that had to have been one of the funnest Battletech scenarios I'd ever been involved in. And it wasn't necessarily that the scenario itself was complicated or tricky that made it interesting. It was just the fact that there was so much energy and enthusiasm at the table, I couldn't not enjoy it. You know, and that's what made it so much fun for me.
I wasn't part of that game at all, and the table I was at was getting pumped up by your guys' game.
And I remember even our house Battletech games, I remember very much that half the fun of the game was the table party.
Yeah, exactly.
That there was just so much energy even within our gaming group around the table.
I think that if we were to play Battletech today, it would be a very mechanical and thorough experience that would be not much fun at all.
Number seven.
Much like making love to Pat.
Yeah, that's true.
Set more realistic expectations for the game. Huge, involved, super long campaigns may not be possible anymore. We're experiencing this ourselves right now. We had a really good Skies of Glass campaign. And then
by scheduling.
Yeah, it's just a whole bunch of real life issues came up and basically knocked the game off for 2 or 3 months. And we just...
Yeah, and not even like real life problems like fighting or... somebody got real sick. I mean, it was just like a wedding or a baptism or a holiday or somebody's coming to visit.
A brist,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Pat finally got his brist.
Mm-hmm. Number eight, similarly, set more real expectations for your GMing. Be aware of how much you really can prepare. I have a big problem with this where a lot of times, as the saying, my eyes are bigger than my stomach or whatever, that I sit down, I'm going to prepare this campaign and all this setting and all this information, all these spreadsheets. And yeah, I just don't have that kind of time. Number nine, your gaming group makeup will change. Introduce those people to new ideas and let them introduce you to theirs. Once again, don't keep trying to recreate the gaming group you've always had. Mm-hmm. Except with the new group of people, the games are going to be different, and that's okay. Number 10, life's too short. Don't fight over the little things. Rules lawyering, setting lawyering, science lawyering.
History lawyering.
It just ain't worth it.
Yeah.
And to add to that, because that's on my list, don't take it personal. It's just a game, people. And ultimately, you're just there to have fun. And if you disagree, you disagree. It's just like the story in the forums, the guy who they had a disagreement over a werewolf game, and one guy ended up punching the other guy in the face, breaking his nose, or hitting him with a chair. Yeah.
Somebody just sent me an email, and I'm sorry I don't have the email in front of me, so I can't give you credit, but it was a really good one about how they were playing at a friendly local gaming shop, and there was a rules lawyer sort of disagreement, and the one guy was like, all right, let's take it outside, and the other guy was maybe not thinking that he meant what he said, and was like, okay, let's talk about outside so we don't disturb other people, and punched him, and he's like, player A punched player B, and player B was in the hospital with a broken jaw, and he said player A is now inmate A.
Yeah,
that's totally ridiculous.
And it's
that's just stupid. It's a game. I mean, good heavens. I think, quite frankly, we take this way too seriously as it is.
But, no.
But I mean, even then, I have never, thankfully, been in a situation where I've seen intentional violence in a game.
The most
I've seen people getting yelling angry, matches, but I have never seen anyone throw a punch or hit, you know, stab somebody.
I've seen people get really, really angry before. Like the other day when we were playing Last Night on Earth, Pat, you got very angry.
I did.
Justifiably so, and even though it was your fault.
I was totally stupid.
Yep. I'm sorry, but it was your fault. Yeah. You didn't read the rules. But, I mean, you got really
rules
angry. Yeah, apparently. But yeah, Pat got really angry at, like, you weren't yelling at anybody, but you're like, damn it, this is unfair and it shouldn't be like this. And I'm all pissed off. And I mean, I just looked at you and I'm like, okay, when people get angry, it stops being fun.
Yeah.
So let's stop right here and we'll either try something else or we'll cool off and, you know, it'll all be cool. So let's just stop right here.
All right, Chris, let's hear your list.
Number one, go to Gen Con. Just to live the experience of it. Don't trust the first Fear the Boot foray into Gen Con as any gauge of how it is. It truly is a wonderful convention, whether you game or not. It's just so much fun to see that many people there for the same reason that you're there. And to, in a certain sense, realize that you're not alone and that the hobby is much larger than you think it is.
Yes, Chris is exactly right. If you've never been to Gen Con, at least go for one day and do two things. One is walk through the town, and the same way towns put out banners for major holidays like Christmas, this place decks out for Gen Con. You go to a sports bar, and in the sports bar, they will have D&D posters in the window. And the second thing I would say is go to the exhibitor's hall. I was trying to say dealer's room, but it's really not a dealer's room, but the exhibitor's hall. Like Chris said, you would not believe. I know this is not the biggest hobby in the world, but it's a lot bigger than you may think. Yeah. Sitting there with your group of five guys where nobody you know or nobody you work with games.
You know, on that first point where you're talking about the town really showing out for Gen Con, my understanding is that where Gen Con was before, I think it was Milwaukee.
Yeah, it was Milwaukee.
It was not really welcome there. The locals either didn't care or didn't like all these nerds showing up.
Actually, I think it was welcome there. I think of course, and I don't know the full story either, but I think we kind of just outgrew the space and there were issues more with housing and hotels than anything else. And I know that Milwaukee loved it because that four-day weekend was like a $5 million shot to their local economy just in those 4 days.
The Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce really, really loves its nerds because it's the same way. It generates X millions of dollars for the local economy. And the local retailers know it. And they are like, oh, my God, send in the nerds. Staffs of restaurants will change their uniform to be all geek and role-playing game shirts. Right. They put out huge banners for role-playing games and video games and cool stuff. They cater to gamers. It's just everyone is super, super polite. And they're all like, hey, you guys here for Gen Con? Hey, that's great. I've never played a role-playing game in my life, but it sure sounds fun. Yeah, awesome. And the people really get into it. They really love you there. And I mean, I don't know what it's like the weekend after Gen Con.
Where they're all cussing it.
Yeah. I mean, I have no clue. It could be geek paradise, probably, because I don't live in Indy. But
well, it's also a behavioral issue as well. As we, as a subset, cultural subset, behave pretty well, as opposed to your drunken NASCAR fans who, you know, or your drunken Indy Speedway fans who, you know, do what they do.
Hey,
not to, you know, chastise them all.
I've been to the Indy 500. I like it.
All right, Chris, what's number two on your list?
Number two, take pride in your hobby. You are engaged in a hobby that is unique amongst other hobbies, and it's something that can be enjoyed from cradle to grave. Take pride in it, and don't be ashamed of it, and tell more people about it. Number three, cherish the time you play, which you had already talked about, as well as always switch games, but go back to your classics. Number five, everyone at least and once in their life needs to play Shadowrun, and only to roll a handful of D6. And I mean, by handful, I mean a literal handful. Stick as many D6 as possible in your hand. That's about what you would roll for certain things in Shadowrun. Either that or West End games, Star Wars. One of the two. Take your pick. Number six, the story is the key. Yes, dungeon crawls are fun, But ultimately, it comes down to really what's going on as far as how your characters react to the story that you are trying to create and how they may change and better the story that you're trying to create. If you focus on that, you'll walk away with more cherishable memories than you'll know what to do with.
Yeah, I agree with that for the one simple reason that role-playing games are the one art form that do collaborative storytelling. I don't mean that in the indie sense of the word. I know collaborative storytelling is a particular style of game. It's not what I mean. I'm using the words at face dictionary value, but that's the one thing role-playing games do better than any other hobby on the face of the earth is let you sit down, tell and change and play with a story. Video games can't do it. Novels can't do it. Nothing allows this style of group interaction.
When they do it within a structure that allows things to not get crazily out of hand, you know, instead of playing like the mile marker storytelling game where everyone tells a story from one mile marker to the next and things can become completely outrageous, RPGs, they have a structure that allows everyone to make it so it all kind of maintains that same sense of realism.
Chris, I've never heard of the mile marker game in my entire life.
Oh, yeah. It's a game more that my wife used to play with her family, and they go on long road trips, and someone would start a story at a mile marker, tell that story up until you reach the next mile marker, and then someone has to pick that up immediately and then continue it for the next mile marker and so on and so forth. Hmm. As you go on and on, it has to pick up that story and run with it for a mile.
My parents and I never really did road trips, so I'm an only child, so we didn't have a car full of kids. So it's more like, here's your Game Boy, shut up.
Yeah, that's true. Next up, try as you might, accept the fact that you will never play all the games that you buy and have on your bookshelf. You may want to, and you may read them, but odds are you probably never get to play them.
Yeah,
just like Nobilis.
We're collectors. Yep. All players are notorious collectors.
By the same token, though, don't stop buying games that you know you'll never play. And then, let's see, the last two. This one, at least once in your gaming lifetime, schedule a gaming day that lasts quite a long time and involves a huge battle and a barbecue. And the barbecue is in real life, and the battle, of course, is on the mat. I did this at the conclusion of one of my most successful campaigns, the big final battle. It took many hours, was thoroughly enjoyable, and we took a break about halfway through and fired up the grill, ate, and then went back down and finished the battle, and it was fantastic. Everyone just had a great time, and it just was just a nice thing to do. It was very much fun. I highly recommend it. And last but definitely not least, doesn't matter how long you know them or how long you play with them, never 100% completely trust your players.
Wow.
They're good guys and they're probably nice guys and they come over to your house and help you with yard work or whatever, but you get them at the gaming table and then sometimes something's just kind of just twink and then
I absolutely and totally disagree with that statement.
You totally disagree with it?
I totally disagree with
that
statement.
You know, like most things, I'm going to cut the difference. It depends on the group.
Well, I mean, it's like if you have some complete and total asshat.
Well, not even asshat.
The guy's being an asshat. That's not...
But
this blanket mistrust of players, I think that to pull them into a story, you need to give them more trust. It's
right.
You're, as a GM, I feel it's my job to empower my players. And I don't mean necessarily give them powers, you know, magic lightning bolts and all that stuff, but that's fine too. But to empower them within the story makes it more fun for everybody. It takes workload off me. It gets me excited as a GM because I see where they're kind of taking things and scooting the train off the tracks. And it lets them have fun because it makes them feel that they have a larger part in the story beyond just that one thing that they have in the game,
right,
which is their character. Well, why not give them a little bit more?
And I agree with you that, yes, you do need to trust them, certainly to a certain degree. But I'm talking about never should you have 100% trust.
Are they screwing, though? That's my question.
Well,
who do they end up screwing with that? I mean, do they end up screwing the Game Master, or themselves?
I think it's a very hard to paint with such a broad brush because it depends on the gaming group. But I have seen within some of the gaming groups I've been in that there's going to be somebody at the table who's a great role player, who's a good friend, who's supportive of the game. He's not cheating, but on some subconscious level, he wants his character to succeed. And so he might, you know, kind of slip in a little bit of out of character knowledge or something like that. And so you got to kind of be on your toes. But I'm going to cut that one off for two reasons. One, that might be a bigger topic to explore more fully in a different episode. And secondly, we got a lot of stuff still to cover on Dungeons.
I want Pat to jump in with his, just his brief opinion on that, though.
On the last one, I was going to turn the tables around and come from the opposite side of the table, and the fact that never trust that bastard behind the screen.
What does he have to hide behind that screen?
Exactly.
He hides behind that screen for a reason.
A phone book-sized thing of notes and maps.
I mean, I love you all to death. You know, you're some of my truly best friends, but I don't trust you behind that screen.
It's like anything else. You're just out
to screw me.
You don't trust me. Well, why should I trust you? And it's this culture of mistrust. And obviously, that sounds like something that you'd say at a Mideast Peace Conference, but so it's not.
Wow.
Gaming is not really that deep, but,
you know, we went from being nostalgic and whimsical and whatever to perhaps a little bit platitude-y, however you would conjugate that word.
Is that like a platypus-esque?
No,
be like a platypus?
To have too many platitudes.
No, I just like that.
I know.
Right. Platitudinous.
Wow, it's kind of overly social conversation. Anyway, so let's get down.
That's because Chris is a jerk.
Hey, you're just jealous.
Hey, jerk.
Let's get back to dungeon building.
Why don't you come to St. Louis and back those words up?
Let's take that outside.
All right.
I will give you the biggest barest man hug that you have ever gotten.
I'll scare you so much you'll grow hair.
Yeah, what are you going to do? You're going to show me your pasty white chest? Come on.
You'll never be able to see me in the bright sun, man.
I really like where this is going.
Dungeon building part two. First off,
what the hell's a dungeon? Even from last episode, I am
gracious.
Still
All right.
hung up on this dungeon
that's
thing.
That's fine. You struggle with that quietly while the rest of us go on. All right. I want to throw in a side note here that was mentioned on the forums by Clint Memo and was also mentioned on the blog by Simon. And I don't know if these are actually the same person. I'm guessing they're not.
Is it Clint Memo or Clemento?
Clint Memo.
Clint Memo.
If not,
I always read it. Well,
Clint Memo.
See, I always look at that. I look at it briefly and it looks much more dirty to me. But
all right. Well, anyway, both of them.
I just see him as the guy getting his head bonked.
Both of them gave a piece of advice that I think is very worth mentioning, which is don't be afraid of smaller dungeons. When you go to plan a dungeon, keep in mind that it's okay to have a dungeon with a handful of rooms. Don't feel this weird external obligation that when you sit down, you have to fill up 10 pages of graph paper in order to have done your job. You can have a dungeon that's got three or four rooms and the big bad at the end, and that's okay. If at some point your players are like, why were we in here? And they can't honestly remember, it's probably a sign that you made this bigger than it needs to be. So it's easier on you. It's easier on them. I'm not saying you have to build small dungeons, but what I am saying is don't feel somehow compelled to always build a great big dungeon. So let's get right back where we left off. We talked last time about planning the out-of-character purpose of the dungeon, planning its in-character purpose. Something else that may be helpful is to think about the history of the dungeon. How was it originally built? Okay, we talked about last time, what purpose was it built for? But what's happened to it since it's been built? For example, if this was a mine, it would look like one thing. But if something moves in there, you know, suddenly the kobolds take up residence there, how will they change it? How will they reshape it? Is this a starship that living alien creep has come into and rebuilt to its own purpose? Think about how the history of a dungeon, the evolution of a dungeon, and we're going to get back to something kind of interesting on this and a few items down, but think about how the history of a dungeon may have changed it over time by what's lived there and what's occurred there and how that might change things in terms of how rooms are being used or how the place is structured and so forth. Next big item, monster ecology. Now, in a place like an office building, this may not matter as much. Well, I guess it would still matter. If you've got guards and office workers, where are they stationed? Where do they work? Where do they go to the bathroom? Where do they take their breaks? But in your fantasy dungeons, this is certainly a really big deal for the suspension of disbelief. If you've got a cave full of kobolds, why are they there in the first place? Why are they in certain rooms? For example, why are there three in this room and two in that room and three in this room and two in that room and none come to help the others as you kill them bit by bit? And
or why is there a long, like I said in the last one, why is there a long hallway and a spike pit trap in the front and a swinging acid trap in the back, and their kobolds have been trapped in the middle for hundreds of years?
Why? It's kind of the question of not just why are they living there, but how are they living there? What do they eat? Where do they go to the bathroom? Is this a big deal? Depends on your style of game, but it certainly
helps.
You
have a gigantic dragon right in the middle of it, and he's the big bad. And you start thinking, well, what does the dragon eat? Oh, well, there's lots of kobolds around. Well, why are there any kobolds left? Why isn't the dragon eating all of them?
Or why didn't the kobolds get some sense and take off?
Yeah.
What the heck are they even doing down there, okay?
And why are there Klingons there?
Well, one, in the broad sense, why are they there? For example, are they someone's minions? Are they hiding there? Do they live there? Are they trying to put together an army? So in the broad sense, why aren't they in the dungeon at all? But in the narrow sense, what are they doing? Do these kobolds just sit there all day in the 10-foot by 10-foot room with the treasure chest in it? Just
why didn't they just take the treasure and go live the high life?
Yeah, what is it they're doing simply to pass the time? How are they entertaining themselves? What are their daily activities like?
So you need to have, in addition to our totally pedantic discussion on bathrooms and dungeons, you need to have a game room right next
door. Well, I'm not saying, I don't want to be too ridiculous with this, but what I'm saying is it might help add some depth to it. For example, if while they're down there, they have duties like keeping a particular room clean, you might come into the room to find a goblin with a shovel moving poop. You might come into the dark temple to find a cleric going through his daily rituals or dark sacraments or whatever.
Sweeping.
Or you might stumble into some kind of weird pit game where they've got giant spiders killing each other. I mean, I don't know, but I'm not saying this is a big deal, but it might add something to the depth and believability and the interestingness of the dungeon.
You know, this when you play an MMO, you go into an instance or a dungeon, and it could be a cave or a castle or a temple or whatever, and you have monsters hanging out. I mean, it's literally the game designers might plop down a campfire in the middle of a random grouping of monsters, but that's all they do. And you have these groups that are supposedly part of a tribe or a cult.
And every so often they scratch their butts, and that's about it.
They might make talking motions between two of them, but there's never any interaction. Or if you go to like Scarlet Monster, and WoW is a big one to me, where you have a long hallway and you just have groups of ones and twos just hanging out, discussing eternally. And then you have patrols, and it's just like, there's just talking and patrolling going on.
Something that may make your life a little easier is Clint Memo pointed out that some monsters don't have ecology. For example, a guard robot might need servicing every so often or power source, but might not, depending on the game. If you want to talk fantasy, something like a golem really doesn't have an ecology. He'll just stand there for eternity in a 20-foot long hallway with traps on either end guarding the middle.
Or say you're doing a Shadowrun or Cyberpunk type game. You go into a big corporation or an arcology or even a research base, there's people working. And say you're going in the middle of the night, so you have the cover of darkness and all that. Maybe there's a couple of guys burning the midnight oil. Janitors, you know?
Somebody vacuuming the floor.
Yeah. And that would be an interesting encounter. You know, it's like you have all these super stealth ninja guys, and then you have just some third shift minimum wage janitor waxing the floors, stumble upon our heroes. Well, what do? Oh, we kill them. It's like, guys, you do know that you're the good guys, and this is just some dude working his way through college.
Armed with a push broom.
Yes.
He's working for the enemy.
That's true. He doesn't have to work for the enemy.
That's right.
He could be a Shadowrunner.
He had a choice.
That's right.
He made the wrong one.
He waxed the enemy's floor. Uh-huh.
He's setting a wax trap.
Exactly.
Speaking of traps, that was actually the next item on the list. I put these under two categories. one is natural and the other is unnatural. By natural traps, I just mean hazards within the dungeon. Weakening walls, collapsing floors.
Giant hamsters.
No, that'd probably be an, I don't know, maybe that's a monster. But weakening walls, collapsing floors, running water, lava.
Maybe it's a giant hamster trap.
If it's a starship, there could be a weakening point in the hull that's about to blow and explosively decompress. And
that's messy.
And, you know, this can give you great help on description, too. Because if there's this old crumbling bridge, there's a potential trap. And you can give the guys a tense moment as they're crossing it, and you're rolling dice to see if it falls apart. If they're in a starship and there's a point where the structure is falling apart and you might get an explosive decompression, you can do tons of description about the creaking they hear, and suddenly they hear a little hiss as a little bit of the hull kind of pops and things start coming apart. You can do some neat stuff with that.
How far would you go with that? Say, for instance, you notice that the players just kind of aren't getting the clues you're dropping and they're not getting the tension that you want them to. The hull, for example, they hear a pop and a hiss, and then one of them's like, oh my god, snakes! In all seriousness. Do you kind of tell them, like, no, that's...
I think, yeah, I would direct them in that direction, saying, you notice a loose piece of paper kind of slide across the floor towards a...
Oh my god, air elementals! We're playing Star Trek!
Oh my god, space snakes!
That... are visible.
Space snakes on a spaceship.
Exactly.
I start shooting. Then that's one of those things where paper hilarity snake ensues.
I'm tired of these motherfucking snakes in this motherfucking starship.
Yeah, actually, no, Chad, I'll agree with you. I'm not sure I would do too much with it, because maybe hilarity ensues and you get a great gaming story.
Yeah.
I think the only place that's getting into character deaths.
So. Well, I think what it comes down to is what kind of game you run. We'll use the starship example, too. Let's just assume they're not joking. They really make the jump from snakes to invisible snake aliens moving things, and they're all paranoid and shooting. And from your perspective, gee, that is hilarious. But maybe you're running a really serious game.
Yeah.
And you're trying to build up some really deep, dark tension. Maybe you should kind of go like,
Or hey, so-and-so, the multi-sensor tricorder you're carrying notes, say, dropping air pressure.
Joe, make a science roll. Make a starship architecture role. The skill he took is a dump skill and he never uses. Whether he fails or not, then they start getting on that line of reasoning. Or you could even say it's a leak as the dice are still rolling and tumbling.
And it can also help set the tone of the place, because if there are weakening and collapsing things, it helps give them a sense of the oldness of the place. Mm-hmm. If there are things like rushing water, it helps give you a sense of this is where the place was built. Who would go through the trouble of building a bridge over a river this dangerous? And it once again, it just helps create that sense of history and depth to the place. The other type being unnatural traps, spike pits, flame darts, hidden laser cannons. Once again, think about who would place them there and why. If you're designing this dungeon, what is the purpose of the trap? Why put it here specifically? And if something lives at the other end, assuming this isn't a crypt, how do they get past that? Is there software for the laser cannon that can recognize the ID badge of someone who should be there versus someone who shouldn't? This particular corner, what leads into a vulnerable back corridor of the wizard's bedroom or something? You know, why would you put the traps there specifically? It just helps add logic to the place. The next thing that we asked on our forum was we asked people to suggest tools that they use to help design or play out the dungeon. Okay, so either to design it on paper, or not necessarily on paper, maybe a computer program, or to actually execute it on the gaming table in front of their friends. One of the things that we quickly noticed is the simple ones are still the favorites. Despite the multiplicity of computer programs and sophisticated tools and interactive tables and projectors and motion sensors and hallucinogenic drugs, the favorites are still graph paper, whiteboards,
LSD,
Chessex battle maps,
shrooms.
And you know why? They're relatively cheap, they're portable, they're reusable, they're flexible. You can take a dry erase or wet erase, depending on the product in question, and just go on the fly with it. Here's one that we use. We had some paper that had some 1-inch squares on it, and we just printed off a bunch of copies, and we would line these little 8.5 by 11 pages together. Actually, they weren't 8.5 by 11. They were even number of inches, but I don't remember the dimensions. And I went out and bought a bag of wooden blocks. And what I would do is I would just take these wooden blocks, just like children's blocks, and I would place those down to represent walls and pillars and altars and all that kind of stuff. And it was cheap. It was flexible. Just as easy as drawing on a whiteboard. Here's one that was suggested by a forum user by the name of Tweaker. What he did was he drew out a grid on cardboard or poster board and then cut it into Tetris-like pieces. So you might have squares, T-sections, turns. And what this allows him to do is on the spot, take these pieces out, these building blocks, and arrange them into the layout of the dungeon. So when, as they walk into the main room, you put down the main room and maybe the two hallways you see coming off it. When they turn down one hallway, well, now you start adding the pieces to show them more. And you can, on the spot, build the dungeon. And this will take a little bit of work on your end because you have to graph out and then take a pair of scissors and cut out the individual pieces. But once you've done that, it's a great, cheap, easy way to run your dungeon.
Hey, Dan, you know, jump back to your previous point with the blocks. One thing that will also work as well there that I have seen done is dominoes laid along your long end. You lay them out that way, and that forms your walls. And granted, they're a little bit longer than an inch, but they work great for laying out walls and doors and general sizes of rooms if you're into the using the whole miniatures.
Yeah, and the bag of blocks I got, it's not like they're all the same size. They're all different sizes, different colors. Some are round, some are rectangular, some are square. And so there's a lot of variety I could work with there. Now, along the lines of the little Tetris map things, there are several places, and this one comes from Grungy Dan on the forums. There are several places that offer map tiles you can download and print off, kind of lay together as needed. So you've got to print it off somewhere, but it saves you the work of doing it. And if you want to find stuff like that, just do a search on RPG map tiles on Google. Or if you look on RPG Now, they have a pretty big selection of them. And typically you pay a couple bucks and what you get is a PDF document of a whole slew of these, usually with some kind of a theme or adventure in mind. Print them off, put them on the table, and you're ready to go. And they're professionally drawn. They look really nice, assuming you don't have like a crappy dot matrix printer. This is one that was suggested by Hansel, or Hansel if he prefers, off of our forums. He suggested a little game called How to Host a Dungeon. It's a one-player game of dungeon creation where what you do is you take a dungeon from creation to its flooding with monsters to the appearance of an arch-villain that wants to use it as a base of operations. And it's a little one-player game, but what it may help you do is inspire you. Like, if you want to put a dungeon in, you've got a purpose in mind, but you don't necessarily know exactly how you want it set up. You run through this little one-player game called How to Host a Dungeon, and it, like I said, it works out for you. Here's where the dungeon came from. Here's what happened to it. It takes you through the various stages of its history. And, it, you know, it's fun to play on your own. And on top of that, it'll give you some great ideas for your dungeon. If you've never seen it before, this is not for the weak of wallet. But there's a company called Dwarven Forge that has some unbelievably nice looking dungeon sets. But be prepared to spend a fortune. I'm just mentioning it because it's really cool and it's out there. Look it up if you haven't found it.
Is that the one that has the block casts that you buy and you cast your own bricks? And
No, that's different. They're pre-made. They're cast and painted.
Uh-huh.
And they're basically, most of them are like,
say
probably
about
4-inch squares.
Yeah.
Pat's making this symbol with his fingers to show how big it is. And I just wanted to say, it's about this big.
It's about yay big.
So I can make fun of them.
No, yeah. I actually have played with those. The two GMs that I played with most of my life both have those. And they were able to, you're right, they're expensive, but they were both able to find those like on clearance or whatever. When they first came out, a lot of hobby stores thought, oh, these are going to sell great. So they got them in and then they sat there because they're expensive. And then they would put them on clearance to get rid of them, sort of. And so sometimes you can get lucky, and that's how we got them.
They're expensive, and on top of that, one of the other problems is unless you want to rerun the same dungeon with the same appearance again and again and again, you need such a massive collection of them that, I mean, like I said, it's just way out of the price range of most people.
I know
people.
They had both of them between them. They probably had 4 or 5 boxes of the stuff. And each box, it's about a 2-foot by 2-foot box filled with this stuff. And the other thing is, they're heavy as lead. Dwarven forge, but like dwarf stone, I think they're called. I mean, they are literally, it's like a whatever the material is. It's heavy. It's so they do weigh a ton.
You can get essentially budget versions of those too if you dig around for Mage Knight cast-offs, the clip game from WizKids, because they had a bunch of accessory type things. They had castles and they had castle walls and they had some rooms. They even had some room props, you know, treasure chests and things like that. And that was all, you know, mass market produced, so it was a little bit less expensive. Mm. And since the game, I believe, is not even made anymore, you know, you could still.
I've also seen sci-fi versions of them too. So they do. So
yeah,
you can
they have a starship line.
It's great.
You know, I'm so tempted to call Hansel Hansel right now. I have him friended on Facebook, and he is foolish enough to put his mobile phone number on his Facebook profile.
Call him up
profile,
and ask him how to.
Say, how do you pronounce it? Who is this? Like, no, shut up. How do you pronounce your name?
If we didn't have Chris on Skype, I could dial him up. Yeah. We still have something planned. There is someone.
That's his real name.
There is. Hans is his real name. But there is someone that we are considering drunk dialing on the show at some point. We haven't gotten around to it yet. But anyway, in terms of dungeon mapping software, if you want to go to the computer route, the real favorite that came up again and again and again, and I'm going to credit it to Necronometron, who was the first that suggested it, is a software called Dungenie. All right, let me spell this because it's got a weird spelling. It's Dundjinni, one word, Dungenie, and that seemed to be a real favorite. And I may link some of this off the show notes so you guys can find these more easily.
Because we're shameless corporate shills, so why not?
Well, that, and I'd hate to picture you writing on your dashboard with a magic marker on your way to work.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that was suggested, this was by Harbor Pirate, was there was a game, a video game, called Dwarf Fortress, and there is an online archive of maps.
Have you ever seen Dwarf Fortress?
I know it's a...
It's one of those impenetrable games. I've not played it. Keep hearing about it. And it keeps on intriguing me, and I keep reading about it. I keep getting intimidated. I still don't quite 100% grasp what it is and what you do. All I know is that it's incredibly difficult, and you have to play it a bunch of times before you can even start to get a game going out of
right.
it. But I think you're building a dwarven fortress, and you have people invading, and maybe you don't, and I know you're mining, and you have to balance mining, and...
Well, apparently, there's an
online... Yeah, you build this huge map.
There's a map archive online, and I'll try to pull up the URL for that and put it in the show notes, of maps that people made while playing that game, mm-hmm. which can serve as the great basis for a dungeon map. This is another one that also comes from Tweaker. He suggested going out and grabbing either cheap architectural or home design software. You stop into a place like Best Buy, they've always got like that home 3D designer, and you could use something like that to lay out the dungeon, assuming it's not too big or complicated. If you need things like figs or background tiles and such, consider a source like Reaper, which sells miniatures a heck of a lot cheaper than many other places. Or
better quality, too.
Yeah, good quality, too. Or consider cannibalizing other games such as Descent or HeroQuest. Chris suggested the click games like Mage Knight, and also hit up eBay because you'd be surprised how many people are trying to move their old fantasy figs for
the Chaos Chosen works in anything as your Black Knight Warlord type of guy.
Plot Weaver suggested something called Worldworks, and what Worldworks is they make cardstock modeling stuff. So it's kind of like a diecast sort of thing where you get like, you know, a little thing you cut out of cardstock and you fold it together and do the little puzzle and you end up with a prop for the dungeon. And I'll link this off the show notes as well. Neat Tricks. These are just random little things that occurred to me as I was writing this down, or random little things that people gave us that are great ways of spicing up the dungeon. One is don't always let the tools speak for themselves. What I mean is this, be descriptive. Don't read boringly from notes, but really get animated about where they are, what it looks like, what's going on. The little stuff, like the floor is a little slick with moss and it's dark and your torchlight's barely piercing the darkness. And up ahead, you can hear something scratching and the air here is stale. You know, get into it. Be excited about it. Be descriptive. Don't just be like, okay, you're in a hall that's 5 feet wide and 20 feet long and, you know, and don't, for heaven's sake, don't read from some boring list of notes. There's nothing that kills a game faster than a guy reading out of a module book. Something Tweaker suggested is have the...
Tweaker's just coming through on this episode.
Oh, he is. This is a cruel one, but it's actually, it might be kind of fun if this is the sort of thing your group is into. The dungeon rearranges itself. As you walk down one hallway, it may be noticeably or unnoticeably moving and reconnecting to a different point than where it connected before. You've seen the Harry Potter movies. Think about what the staircases do there.
Is that fun, or is that just annoying?
Depends on the game and the gaming group and how you do it. Yeah. This is one I heard from I don't know if it was a dungeon somebody created or a module. I heard it a while back, had no idea what to credit it for. Invisible walls.
It's called the Dungeon of Broken Noses?
Yeah. You see a large open room. You can see everything that's there. But the walls themselves...
You see a greasy face print floating in front of you.
Well, I think that was how the group finally solved it, was they started taking like chalk or something, trying to deface these things so they could tell where they were going.
Does an invisible wall have friction? Or is it completely frictionless?
I guess that depends on whether it's...
an energy field? Yeah. I mean...
That's up to your imagination.
Really?
This is a common...
In a role-playing game? I can do anything.
This is a common sense one that comes from forum user Husser.
Is that Chris Hussey's sock puppet?
I hope not.
Yes, it is.
Excellent.
Which is, you don't have to spend your entire time lost. They do this in Zelda. It's okay to do it in your role-playing game as well. Drop maps of the dungeon or map fragments. If something intelligent lives down...
Oh my
down,
god, I actually read this one. He was saying he was running World's Longest Dungeon, and the module, which is the world's longest dungeon, it's a huge, gigantic thing, and it was getting tedious for the players, so he's like, man, these guys are getting lost, it's getting tedious, we need to get to the fun, cool stuff. They had an idea, he dropped a map fragment of the section that he wanted them to go to. He's like, oh, well, they got it. That was awesome. This worked. And he started dropping more and more, and the players like loved it.
Well, it's a great way also to make, because we've talked about how props draw people in.
Yeah.
Take a piece of paper. If something intelligent lives down there, or something intelligent has been there in the past, like another adventurer or an explorer or something, then there may be a rough map of the dungeon.
How intelligent are you to draw a map of the entire dungeon and then backtrack halfway through and rip it in half?
Well,
it's like, oh no, I need to find my way out. Let's leave a breadcrumb of my half-drawn map.
Part of it could have been burned or chewed up or partially digested by the gelatinous
cube. That's something you never see, is you see map fragments that are torn or they're burnt, but you never see one with a bite mark taken out.
Yeah. So there's a way to make the dungeon a little easier. And especially if you're in the future, something like a starship, there's a very good chance
they need
deck plans.
Yeah. Well, no, I was thinking if you're on a starship, you need a torn up burnt piece of vellum with hand drawn. But no.
The downside, I'm just trying to picture how this would have happened. Like,
you got to think that's got to be a great
the
story.
The janitor's chewing on half of it while he's push brooming the other half of it towards a dumpster. But
that's got to make a great
story. The obvious possible downside to this is if you give them a map of the dungeon, they may cruise through it too quickly. They may pick a path plot and be like, we're going to go from here to here. And they blow past all the description and all the plot and all the interesting stuff you put in there.
Well,
so know your gaming group.
That's the problem with having like a static, hard-drawn map. Not necessarily what the players see, but either in your mind or in a piece of paper or a map you're following. If we're, I guess, quote, overland, and we're talking about the adventure, and the players decide to go to town B when you need them to go to town A, because all the plot and stuff's in town A, well, you can just easily say, hey, all that cool stuff, it's in town A now. Mm-hmm. I think you're a little limited in that regard, because, I mean, you have to go through architectural revisions. Now, granted, the soft stuff, the role-playing imagination stuff, can be in different rooms that you didn't plan on them going to, but they went to anyway. You can move where the main villain is and all the accoutrements of his room to a different section, but it would be difficult in mid-game to redraw your plans on the fly. What would you do in that situation where something happens unforeseen, and we won't even get into the examples of why that would happen, but what would you do? You have a large map drawn out behind your holy GM screen of non-players seeing, I don't trust my players, and it's all drawn out, and you have to make a big change to the map. I mean, architect, like the room, it's just like, this won't make any sense. This ship won't fly. This dungeon doesn't make any sense. They've done something to fundamentally change it, and I've got to change it. I mean, what do you do?
I don't know, outside of it's just, you've got to be quick with the pen, and if nothing else, this is maybe where you say, okay, guys, give me a minute, because you just changed things, and I want to react.
All right, smoke break.
Yeah.
You've only been gaming for 10 minutes. Yeah, and you need a cigarette.
But I guess that's what you do, is you just be quick with the pen and redraw it and do what you got to do.
Maybe highlighters. Yeah. I mean, it sounds silly, but, you know, highlighters that you can redraw over the map, if it's paper, mind you, that you can redraw over the map, and it won't crush what you originally, or won't erase what you originally had. But
something I want to stress here, and this is kind of my closing thought on dungeon design.
Thank God.
Is I am a big believer that your dungeon ought to be consistent, well-developed.
And when you look at it in an overhead map, it looks like a naked lady.
Well,
like you said, interesting.
Unless you unfocus your eyes, in which case it looks like an old lady wearing a hat.
Yeah.
Interesting, you know, well-designed, all that kind of stuff. But when we talk about realism, there is a great thought, which I don't think we conveyed directly. I think it was implying some things we were saying. But the gentleman on the blog I mentioned earlier, goes by the name of Simon, made a post that I think really drives home something about realism in regards to a dungeon. I'm going to read a short and kind of cut up version of his post.
What you're
here.
Saying is that you're going to take his post and make it better.
I'll make his post to make it shorter, because me reading from a piece of paper is not how I want this podcast to go. But here's what he says. Realistic doesn't actually have anything to do with reality as we know it. A realistic dungeon is a dungeon that is consistent with the reality of the fiction it is placed in. And when that fiction has magic, superpowered monsters, humans as neither the only intelligent species nor at the top of the food chain, actual gods, alternate dimensions, etc. For instance, tunnels don't have to be mined out when there are giant burrowing worms, footnote here by Dan, which could be following any willy-nilly path, creatures that melt stone, the hollow remains of a giant fallen god skeleton that got buried in molten rock when the world was still young, and so on. And I think he is absolutely right, that the dungeon ought to be consistent, interesting, well-designed, well-developed, blah, blah, blah. But when we're talking about realism, the realism that you need is a realism that's consistent to the fiction, not necessarily a realism that is consistent to Earth today as we know it. So, wow, this looks like this is going to come out to be, also looks like it's going to
work. I have a question, though.
Sure, go ahead.
So, if I'm running a game and I'm doing this dungeon thing, have it mapped out, and it's cool. And the players are following along, and they don't see my map, right? Because it has all my notes of where the bad guys are. And they're mapping it, and I notice they're mapping it incorrectly. Their map doesn't match up with my map, which is the map. What do you do?
Well,
because on one hand, I say, well, hilarity ensues. But on the other hand, I'm sensing lots of frustration on both the players and the GM.
I would say that's what I'd go with, is I'd read the group. If they mapped it wrong because I described something ambiguously by accident, which happens all the time in GMing, then I would say, guys, just to be more clear, the hallway was like this. If it was their mistake, their genuine mistake, if they drew it wrong, I would say go with hilarity ensues until you start sensing frustration or them headed that direction. And at that point, say, guys, wait a minute, let me correct something here. This actually looked like that. Because as we've said many times, ultimately, the real point here is for people to have fun. If you're being such a hard ass about this, that it's like, no, they must figure this out on their own, and your players are miserable and annoyed and bored, you have wrecked the game. Yeah. You have wrecked the purpose of gaming. And so I would just completely metagame it and say, guys, FYI, you know, let me do
hold up the piece of paper and say, 5 seconds.
Well, or even just take a pencil and go over to their piece of paper and mark it up a little bit and say, no, it looked like this.
So,
I had a lot of fun doing this thing on dungeon design. I thought it'd be fairly dry, but there's some really interesting stuff that came out of it. I want to give a big thanks to all the forum users and all the blog posters that came out with suggestions, including those of you that may not have gotten mentioned just because somebody beat you to the punch on an idea. But anyway, we may tap you guys again for things in the future where we just feel the topic's bigger than what we can wrap our heads around, because there's just too many good ideas out
there. There's not many topics like that, let me tell you.
But anyway.
And Pat may tap you anytime he feels like it.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
If he ever shows up in the forums.
Oh, I read them all the time.
Yeah. Pat is a classic lurker.
I am.
You are a classic lurker.
All right, alert.
Well, they bitch about Pat. Well, thank you guys for tuning in.
Damn it, Pat.
Have fun with your dungeons, and we will catch you next time.
Later.
Stupid Pat.
Later, days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.